AI isn't Max Headroom anymore. I mean, it's a lot. Deep fakes are really, really good now. It's not Forrest Gump meeting John Kennedy. It's a lot better than it used to be.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where we break down the most important stories in the field with the help of our panel of expert practitioners. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski. Today's stories, a postmortem for scattered Lapsus hunters, AI-powered prompt lock ransomware is just a proof of concept, one phishing email leads to 20 compromised NPM packages, a new IBM X-Force analysis digs into the major threats facing OT and critical infrastructure. Business identity compromise scams give hackers legitimate jobs for illegitimate reasons. Plus, the story of an enterprising threat actor who, for some reason, installed Huntress EDR on their own device. And I hear we have a hot take on CVSS scores that I'm dying to get into. It's a packed episode, so let's introduce our cast of characters. First up, Michelle Alvarez, Manager, X-Force Strategic Threat Analysis. Michelle, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Also, keep an eye on our podcast feed for an in-depth discussion with Michelle on why it costs so dang much to get hacked in America, which should be coming in the not-too-distant future. We also have Sridhar Mpidi, IBM Fellow, CTO, IBM Security. Sridhar, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Matt. Looking forward to the discussion.
Sridhar also has a long-form interview coming down the pipeline. His is on the complexities of securing AI identities in the enterprise. And Dave Bales of X-Force Incident Command, one host of the Not the Situation Room podcast and the only person I've heard make a Dick Dastardly reference in the year 2025. Dave, how you doing?
I'm well. I'm a little jealous that I don't have a long-form interview coming up.
You know, I was about to say, we got to figure out what yours is going to be because, I mean, you can't be the only one, you know? Yeah, think about that in the background. All right, let's dive into our stories. First up, scattered Lapsus hunters call it quits, or do they? The collaboration no one wanted, to quote X-Force's Claire Nunez, announced last week that it would be going dark. In a message posted to breach forums, they left open the possibility that more breaches will be attributed to them in the future, especially among airlines. But they said that these are breaches they already did. It's nothing new. They just haven't been discovered yet. They also framed their work as a quote-unquote war on power, meant to, and these are quotes, I didn't make this up, humiliate those who humiliate and predate those who predate. Which that's kind of a new interpretation for me. I don't really see how that's making any sense with what they're doing, but we'll discuss that. So to start, I want to ask, is this really the end of scattered Lapsus hunters? And I'm going to start with Dave, because I know your podcast has discussed these guys a few times now. So I'd love to get your take. What do you think? Are they really gone?
Not a chance. There's no chance that they are gone. This is a ruse. This is a look at the right hand while the left hand's doing something else, as I've said before. We've seen threat groups come and go. They've said they were going to leave, and then they come back. I can't remember the last one that I saw, but
I think there was one, 2011, Dave, Luxec.
There's been a few. Yeah. They come out and they say, we're going to go away, and then they don't. And the fact that they said that there's going to be some more breaches attributed to them tells me that they haven't happened yet, and they will. And that's when they're going to get attributed.
I found that very suspicious, too. Michelle, I saw you leading in to speak.
Well, I was just going to sort of anecdotally, I liken it to when my parents said they were retiring, and then 6 months to a year later, they're working again. It's like, well, we just spend all this money on your retirement party. What do you mean? But to Dave's point, I'm not going to disagree with him. I think this, I don't know if it's authentic, right? Because I've seen other researchers say that it's not and bring up some really valid points as to why it isn't. And we've seen, historically speaking, these groups either, you know, reform. I don't think they're going away.
Yeah, I think I agree with both Michelle and Dave, right? I think the one thing, Matt, that you mentioned about the message of fighting the power, right? That seems more like a psychological justification, like you know, Robin Hood type, right? Being able to go and justify what you're doing, I guess, whatever makes you sleep better at night, right? But I think I agree with Michelle that, you know, this is probably a ruse to go and deploy something bigger, better, different flavor.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that war on power stuff, because that also just, it boggled my mind. I mean, what's the point of that? I don't know. It's hard for me to see anything like righteous in what they're doing. So I'm just wondering what the point is in framing it like that. Any thoughts on that from the panel? Like why they would frame it that way?
I spoke this morning with a couple of coworkers about the fact that this is a really easy way for them to kind of throw the law enforcement trail cold. It doesn't really work. It's like someone getting pulled over and saying, I didn't do anything. And the officer saying, oh, well, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It doesn't work. The war on power, they want to declare war on those in power. I mean, is that the smartest move for an APT to announce to everyone? I don't think so. I think that they're actually probably going to go after smaller targets at first and then kind of ramp up from there. And that's why I don't think they're going to go away. I think they're actually going to be around for a while.
Gotcha. So do we think the kind of main thing here is just, you know, you go quiet to get the heat off of you a little bit, maybe get law enforcement to back down. And then, like you said, in the meantime, Dave, maybe you're poking around at some smaller stuff before you ramp back up. Do we think that's the kind of the gist of what's happening here?
No, I think so. I think this is an opportunity to, you know, regroup, reset, rethink the strategy. And a lot of things have changed these days, right? In terms of the tools that we're using, the type of attacks that we want to make. You know, sometimes the return on investment is not there to go and launch a high-powered ransomware attack when you can just simply hack into a system with compromised passwords, right? So with all these things going on and the side of Gen AI and agents, right, looming around, what do we do? You know, how do we go create a new identity? If I were them, I'm going to step back and rethink, probably keep something small going just for the time being, but then launch something which is more 2025, 2026 focused.
Yeah, well, it sounds like I'm going to have to cancel my beautiful memorial then for Scattered Lapses Hunters.
Well, they've only been around for, what, a month or so? I mean, and now they're just disappearing?
You know, that's the other thing too, right? They just popped up like a month ago. They're like, hey, we got this new ransomware, and then they're just gone, you know? So I guess it was too good to be true, wasn't it? It does sound like this is just a ploy. This is not.
Or there's just a lot of infighting and they just can't get along.
If you have three of these groups coming together, I could see that. I could see some infighting going on, some, you know, egos getting in the way, and maybe they're going to break up the band and go their separate ways again.
Or they need a new kind of music.
There you go.
That's
a new kind of music. There we go. There we go. Let's move on to our next story then. AI-powered ransomware PromptLock turns out to be proof of concept from NYU. Now, I don't know if you folks remember, but in late August, PromptLock kind of made some waves as, quote-unquote, the first AI-powered ransomware when it was discovered on VirusTotal, I believe. The way that it works is it uses an open-weight model from OpenAI to generate malicious scripts on the fly. Last week, researchers from the NYU Tandon School of Engineering clarified that they created it as a proof of concept for what they call Ransomware 3.0. This is a hypothetical malware that uses LLMs to orchestrate the entire attack chain. The researchers write, and this is a quote, "The system performs reconnaissance, payload generation, and personalized extortion in a closed-loop attack campaign without human involvement." Now, about a year ago, I wrote a story for IBM about AI malware. I wanted to see if it was a big deal, as if it was something we should be afraid of. I talked to a bunch of malware engineers at X-Force, and every single one of them said, it's not a thing. Don't worry about it. It's all overblown. But now I'm wondering, a year later, is it a thing? Is it something we need to worry about? And I'm going to throw it to Michelle first here, I think. What do you think? Are we finally at a point where AI malware like PromptLock could be an issue? What do you think's going on?
Well, I think the real concern is that now it's more accessible to maybe other would not be hackers, right? So I think this is likened to when we started seeing exploit kits available for sale. Now you have individuals, bad guys, that wouldn't have otherwise known how to develop an exploit can just purchase it. So I think that is the main concern, because in the end, what is the impact? The impact is going to be the same to the organization.
Sridhar, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think, I mean, from a research perspective, can it be done? Absolutely. We've done it, right? We've done it in IBM. I think I look at it as very similar to automotive manufacturers testing their cars, crashing their cars with a view to improve it, right? So I absolutely endorse doing something like that, but do it responsibly. Do it with a view to show that, you know, how you're improving the defense, as opposed to highlighting the fact that you can go and create an attack autonomously, right? We do it all the time, the question of, you know, red teaming and blue teaming. And we learn from the red agent to be able to go and do a better job of defects, right? So I agree with the research. I think it's absolutely possible, but do it in a manner of responsible AI and do it with their defense and focus with transparency, right?
I'm glad you brought up that ethical angle, and I want to dig into that in a minute. But first, Dave, I want to get your thoughts. Do you think the AI ransomware or AI malware in general is something we need to start worrying about right now?
I just wrote one this morning. No, I think so. With AI becoming more prevalent and becoming smarter, with smarter people programming, I mean, let's face it, the AI is only as good as the people programming it. We've got some pretty smart people. Like Sridhar said, we've already done it here at IBM. The difference is that we didn't put it out to the public.
Exactly.
And that's where I was going to go. As soon as you said that, I knew, oh, good. We get to talk about the fact that someone released a proof of concept in order to help us.
Yeah, I want to ask about that, right? I mean, it just, I don't know. Look, I'm not a researcher. I'm not in the lab making this kind of stuff. But it does feel a little irresponsible to me to be releasing this to the public. I'm just wondering, is this common practice, first off? Like, do people usually release this proof of concept stuff, or do you usually keep it kind of hidden, Sridhar?
Okay to release, but with the appropriate disclosures and you know, how to use it, right? For example, if you release it with the data set, make sure you test your applications with this quote-unquote red agent so that you can do a better job of defense. I think it's okay. It's like any other technology, internet, good and the bad, nuclear power, good and the bad. Similarly, there's good and bad over here, but doing it responsibly will hopefully stay ahead of the malicious actors.
Gotcha. And so what does doing it responsibly look like? Michelle, I saw you starting to speak there, so I'll let you go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what is going on here is that there's a race to beat the attackers at their own game, right? So we're all the good guys, all the researchers are trying to see, okay, how can this be done? And therefore, this is how we defend against this. And so to Sridhar's point, yes, there's ways about it to do it more responsibly, contacting perhaps the organizations or the entities that would need to know about this. So maybe the AV vendor providers first. Let's start there. We have this proof of concept ransomware. We want to make sure that you can detect it.
Gotcha. Dave, any thoughts on responsibility here?
The fact that they released it publicly is where I have the issue, because the researchers aren't the only ones looking at these proofs of concept. The bad guys are getting these as well. And that, you know, if we're going to talk about responsible disclosure for these proofs of concept, we need to keep it within the cyber community and not let it get out to the public. That, to me, is more important than releasing a proof of concept to the public to show, hey, we can do this. Give it to the cyber researchers who know what to do with it. Keep it that way. So while I disagree that it was responsible for them to release it, I do agree that releasing it to the cyber community is a smart thing to do.
Yeah, this reminds me of, you know, on the last episode, we were talking about HexStrike AI, right? Which is that framework that a bunch of, you know, it's supposed to be used for automating penetration testing and orchestrating all your agentic AI. And a bunch of hackers just kind of picked it up immediately, right? And this came up again and again and again. And I think it was Nick Bradley who said that, you know, if you're worried about hackers misusing your tools, you would never move forward, right? Any tool you develop, someone's going to be able to misuse it. And so it's a question of being responsible about it, whether that means disclosing it to people before you do it, or like Dave said, maybe you only give it to a very select number of people.
Yeah, it may be difficult though, right? If you recall, Dave, you probably remember this Satan, right, way back in what, late 90s, early 90s? I don't remember that.
Jeff Kroom mentioned this on the last episode. I think he said it was like early 2000s, I want to say.
Yeah, probably even before that. But I mean, Yeah, I mean, it was a tool to go and do network scanning with a view to find vulnerabilities. All of a sudden, that became a mechanism to find holes and publish TTPs, right? So I think tools like this will get out of hand, good or bad. You know, they'll be produced for their one reason or the other. They'll get into wrong hands. We have to go figure out how to brace ourselves against such things, right? That's where I would probably focus a little bit as well.
And wasn't Satan like the impetus for Nmap?
Yes.
It spawned Nmap out of that. Correct. So
yeah,
there's a good tool that came from it, but there was also a lot of bad that came with it. So
exactly.
Moving on then to our next story, a single phishing attack against a single developer leads to 20 compromised packages on NPM. I think people have probably heard of this because it's one of the kind of biggest hacks of NPM ever, I believe. A prominent developer was hit by an AI-assisted phishing attack that stole his NPM credentials, allowing threat actors to compromise 20 packages, which, according to the Hacker News, collectively attract over 2 billion weekly downloads, which I don't know, that seems like a lot of downloads. I don't know, but that's a lot. It's a lot. The malware buried in these packages intercepts cryptocurrency transactions. It reroutes them to attacker-controlled wallets. And the attack used a combination of clean email infrastructure and AI-generated content to get past both technical defenses and the developer's own kind of, you know, psychological warning signs. This looked like a legitimate email from NPM about resetting 2FA credentials. So I want to start by asking what this situation says about the kind of current state of software supply chain security. And I want to refer to you first, Sridhar, because we've talked a little bit in the past about supply chain, specifically regarding AI stuff. But I just want to hear your thoughts. You know, what does this say about the state of software supply chain security today?
I think it's not where it should be, right? As simple as that, right? You know, this actually demonstrate a single point of failure, right? You know, you've got such critical software that is used by millions of individuals, millions of organizations, maintained by somebody who's just probably doing it out of the goodness of his or her heart, right, as a part-time. And as a result, you know, bad things have happened, not focusing on how it happened, but the fact that it has happened, right? And we should think about, you know, how do we go mitigate against that, right? This reminds me, actually, as bad as it may sound, and they will probably disagree, sometimes these things are necessary, right? Sometimes these things are necessary. Like, you know, I very earlier on during my undergrad, I learned about, I think Tylenol, if I remember right. Somebody messed with the Tylenol and put tablets and impacted a few people, and that resulted in a tamper-proof, you know, cap. I think, to me, things like this are unfortunately necessary to be able to think about, you know, secure supply chain software and think about the level of rigor, verification, transparency needed, very similar to how we think about food safety, right? From the time that, hey, this avocado was grown in this farm all the way to this manufacturer to my table, right? That level of software bill of material transparency is probably going to help us in the future.
Dave, go ahead. I want to see if you disagree or not.
No, actually, I'm not going to disagree with that. I think it's right. I'll give you an analogy. We talk about dumb rules. Well, the rules came about because someone did it. And sometimes we need these phishing attempts, yeah, these events to further security. And normally, I would just play devil's advocate here and disagree just for fun. But seriously, I think it's actually a good thing when something bad happens, but a good result comes from it. So I can't disagree at all.
It's like the little warning on the silica gel packet, right? That says "Do not eat." Somebody had to
Someone
eat it
ate it
for that to get there.
Someone ate it.
Michelle, any thoughts on your end on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the software compromises, it's just another flavor of third-party compromise, right? And this is a huge issue for organizations because, okay, I've got my perimeter, right? And I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, but oh, that third party that I do business with, they're not secure, right? And how many of those partners and contractors and other third party organizations are entities working with that you just have this massive attack surface? And so, and then you couple that with the social engineering, like that is the biggest issue right now.
Massive amount of trust between companies when you have third party companies working together. There's just, you have to trust who you're working with.
Yes. And so what do you do about that, right? You have this, like you said, there's this massive attack surface. You got to have all this trust. But as, you know, Sridhar, as you said, we have to find ways to secure that as much as we can. And you started, you mentioned a little bit like a software bill of materials kind of thing. I wondered if you wanted to expand a little bit on that concept, right?
I think it's very similar to what you said, right? Do not eat, right? It's being able to go and list exactly the genesis of, you know, what software package is coming from where, having the information in there, who touched it, to the level of transparency so that we know if some changes are happening and they're anomalous in nature, then we understand the blast surface, right? The transparency is what I want to highlight out of that software bill of materials rather than the how part, right?
It's not so much that it was one phishing email.
Yeah.
And the shocker for me is that they're going after cryptocurrency. I've just never heard of that before, but...
Yeah, cryptocurrency scams. Who does that?
What is that? Yeah. But yeah, it's not the how. It's the product of, you know, the multiplication table that it comes from. So
I think just having just a software bill of materials is not sufficient, right? Being able to have that continuous verification of the package, being able to look for anomaly detection, right? Coupled with the transparency of the software bill of materials will help the overall equation, right? There's no single silver bullet per se.
And Michelle, you had mentioned the kind of social engineering angle of this thing, right? And I think that's another interesting kind of lesson from this whole situation is that, you know, you have somebody who's a pretty savvy developer, someone who knows their way around this stuff. If they get the right message at the right time or the wrong message at the wrong time, depending on how you define that, what does this say kind of about the state of social engineering today, right? That like even somebody like this can get hit. And Michelle, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, we're all human. And I think if anyone in security says that they've never been duped, I would say that they're lying. Because I think we've all, you know, we've all fallen for something. Dave's looking around, but I'm sure, look, think hard, think back. Even
oh,
Sridhar.
I'm not denying it. I have.
Right, right.
And IBM has gotten me twice.
And that's great, right? Because that's probably a testament to their training. So obviously, we always tout user education and training, and it seems very cliche, but it's true and it works. And it has to be adapted for the times. What are they actually doing? What are they leveraging? How are they getting in? And that needs to be sort of embedded into the training that an organization is doing. We're under so much pressure, right? And we have so many things going on. It's very easy to just act quickly without taking a minute. And I think what we have to do is just start every day with, okay, this is my baseline. This is what I'm going to do when I get an email, when I see a message, when I get a phone call. And that's hard to do because we have so many things going on.
Right. We have to assume that these things are going to happen. Right, we cannot assume that nobody's, you know, you can avoid phishing. You can assume that somebody's lost their password or iPad or whatever it is, done that. So, to Michelle's point, yes, I have lost a laptop.
Is Sridhar going to be the only one brave enough to admit? Is anybody else going to cop to it? No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Getting back on point. Yeah, I think you have to assume that some of these things are going to be compromised, right? So the question is, how do I put, you know, controls around it so that you can assume some of this, right? So, and that's what I think. I mean, when you asked me the question, I was in two minds to answer it by saying, you know what, I'm glad it happened, but I stopped myself. Because sometimes it is time that something like this happened so that it becomes an awakening call.
I think it's actually okay to say that, though, yeah, that you're glad it happened because it's going to teach someone something.
Yeah, it honestly reminds me a lot of our previous conversation here about the prompt lock stuff in the sense that, like,
yeah,
sometimes someone's got to do something a little bad for something good to come out of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We've got a new IBM X-Force analysis, finds that OT and critical infrastructure face serious threats. Quote, many ransomware, advanced persistent threats, and cybercrime groups are going beyond data theft, aiming for physical disruption and even sabotage. This is from David McMillan, who is the author of the blog post breaking down this analysis. Now, by fusing frontline threat intel with some 2025 cost of a data breach data, the IBM X-Force identified some concerning trends in OT and critical infrastructure, including a significant number of serious vulnerabilities in the fields. Of the 670 vulnerabilities disclosed in the first half of 2025 that could impact operational technology, nearly half have a CVSS severity rating of critical or high. So I want to start with you, Michelle. Can you give us a little context about this analysis, a little background about what all this is?
Basically fuses some data that we got from the cost of a data breach, a survey conducted by Ponemah Institute and analyzed by IBM, that showed that 15% of organizations actually experienced an OT incident, right? So then we looked at our own data, like you mentioned, over 600 vulnerabilities impacting OT technology providers or vendors. And then subsequently, we looked at, okay, what are we seeing being mentioned from either in Telegram channels or dark web or other forums to see, you know, what are some of the top vulnerabilities that are being mentioned out there and therefore maybe are of interest to attackers as well. And then beyond that, right, how many of those CVEs have exploits that are publicly available? So there's obviously interest in targeting OT technology, but beyond that, it's more about the industries that house the OT technology, right? We're looking at utilities and electric and the grid, right? So all of these different industries, and they have these, you know, OT environments, and that's why they're susceptible.
And why are so many attackers kind of moving beyond data theft right now, right? Like, why do you think we see people targeting OT and critical infrastructure for disruption specifically? Any thoughts on that stuff, Michelle?
So I think it's going to come down to the threat actor and the motivations, whether they're a nation state sponsored threat actor or their cyber criminal group. So I don't know that we've necessarily are seeing a move away from data theft. I think we have reports to the contrary of that. It's really going to come down to the threat actor group and what their motivations are.
Gotcha. Sridhar, any thoughts to add?
Right, Matt. I think it's easier, right? You know, the technology is, you know, not necessarily the state of the art, right? And policies and procedures are not state of the art, right? So as a result, if you have a castle with moat, why can't I bring an air attack? It's easier to launch it. You can even get it with a Cessna and still make a devastating impact, right? It doesn't have to be a... So that's the way I look at it. It's an easy thing to do, right? Why invest a lot in sophisticated attack when I can, you know, do something simple, number one. And number
launch
two
a water
is,
balloon?
Yeah, exactly. Right? Or the other part is that, I know, back to Michelle, the motivation point, right? It's a lot more appealing and easier to extract something out of it, right? From an attacker perspective. You're dealing with Colonial Pipeline, if you remember that, or, you know, a power grid, and it's easy to go and get what the attackers want, whether it is ransomware or whatever that is, to not disrupt millions of, you know, citizens' life.
Dave, what are your thoughts on it?
I think it comes down to money. When you start messing with water supplies, power grid, the trucking industry even, people are more willing to pay to get those systems back online, as opposed to information, where now that we've been dealing with this information theft for so long, a lot of companies are starting to fix their security policies and make their backups, and they take them off site and they make sure that they have more than one. It's really kind of hard to do that with a water supply or a trucking industry or a power grid. If it's down, it's down. If you want to bring a country to its knees, shut down its trucking supply and turn off its water. You can leave the power up. It'll be fine. But if you can't get food and you can't drink water,
You're right. You can't make a backup of your water supply, like you said. Right. Right? Like that's exactly. You got one and that's it. But Sridhar, you also mentioned that a lot of this technology is not like state of the art, or maybe it's not kind of patched properly. I mean, why is that? Is it just a kind of cost benefit analysis going on? Or they're like, we don't want to take it offline to patch. What's the deal there?
I think it's a combination. Like if you look at the attack entry points, like PLC controller or logic card boards, right, on a CNC machine or something which is operates a relay, those are not necessarily the, you know, updated on a regular basis. It does take downtime to update those, right? So as a result, they stay there for a long time, and the vulnerabilities over there are something that, you know, attackers exploit. So part of it is, you know, the technology, where the technology is, and you don't get the latest and greatest software on a PLC controller for something, right, or a relay. And most of that goes into something like, you know, training LLM models with GPUs. Right? So that's the one of the reasons why the technology is a little bit dated, number one. Number two, I think, is also security has always been kind of an afterthought, right? You know, for critical infrastructure, being able to keep the uptime high has always been the highest priority. And operations, security don't necessarily talk to each other. But when you start talking about safety, when you talking about downtime, that's when there's an opportunity for these entities to talk to each other. Otherwise, they're in silos and attackers take advantage of their silos.
Now, I want to go back to that figure of the vulnerabilities, right? 670 vulnerabilities disclosed in the first half of 2025 that could affect operational technology. 49% of them were either critical or high in terms of CVSS rating. And I'm wondering, you know, this sounds pretty concerning. And I want to kind of throw it to Dave, because I know Dave has thoughts on CVSS. So I want to get your take on this, Dave, both in terms of this number and also CVSS in general. I want to hear what you got to say.
I'll tackle the CVSS thing really quick. I think it's completely broken. There's so many vulnerabilities now that are unscored that show a score of 9.8, which is the default. So everything that's unscored shows up as critical, and you can't take that number and perform any kind of analysis with it, because you don't actually know that it's a critical vulnerability. I think it needs to be redone, and there's been talk about them redoing the CVSS model for years now, and it hasn't happened. And I just, I'm not a fan of using a CVSS score to rate a vulnerability. You need to know what the vulnerability is. You need to know how it works, how it affects everything. And you can't do that with a number. You have to actually see it. So, and the fact that 675, come on.
I think I agree with Dave on this, right? We need to think about how susceptible it is to go and launch that, you know, or take advantage of the vulnerability, not about the number, right? You can have 9.9 and nobody's going to touch it, 9.8, but nobody's going to touch it. Why would I, right? Instead, I may go after like something lower, which is easy to exploit. Instead, we should think about something like a weaponization score, like how easy or susceptible it is to leverage or exploit that vulnerability and try to patch those, right? So 600 doesn't mean anything. Out of the 600, maybe the 20 may be easily exploitable. Patch those first.
Michelle, you have any thoughts on whether CVSS score is worth it? If it's broken, what do you got?
I don't know if I have any thoughts specifically on the CVSS scoring, but I would say that, yes, to Sridhar's point, if it's exploitable, or if there's public exploit available, right, proof of concept or exploit already, it's already being exploited in the wild. We see reports of threat actors leveraging it. That should probably raise it, right? And obviously, if you don't have a particular technology in your environment, you're not going to worry about that. So maybe of those, you know, there's a very small percentage that would be impacting you. So yeah, understanding what your assets are first and foremost, right? Because that's already a problem, even though that's sort of part of basic security, is understanding your assets and asset management. And then knowing of those, if something goes down, that's going to have this ripple effect.
I would say to issue a challenge to the viewers and the listeners, go and do some research and find out how many critical vulnerabilities are publicly exploited and how many of those mediums are actually exploited. And I think you'll find that the numbers are surprising in that the mediums are more exploited than the criticals, because there's just so much high profile visibility on the criticals. Like Sridhar said, those mediums can be way more dangerous than the criticals.
I like this. This is our first listener viewer challenge. I expect some answers in the YouTube comments, okay? Business identity compromise is the hot new social engineering scam, or at least it's one of the hot new social engineering scams. In business identity compromise, also known as BIC or simply hiring fraud, attackers pose as legitimate workers applying for remote roles, often using AI tools to generate resumes, headshots, even voice and video, and of course, do the work they need to do to keep the job. These insider threats then use their access to sensitive company systems to wreak havoc, or they just draw a paycheck and use it to fund illegitimate activities. So I want to start by asking, what's up with this, the rise of BIC? Why do you think this kind of thing is taking off right now? Dave, I want to start with you. You got any thoughts on why BIC is getting popular right now?
I think it started getting popular when the work from home became a really big thing. A lot of people didn't have an office to go into, so it was really hard to see those threat actors that actually got into these companies and maybe focus on what they were doing. You know, you see someone who, you know, suspicious looking over there. What's he doing over there? When they're in their homes, there's nothing to look at. You can see their work. And if they're doing a good job at their job, you know, if they're doing good work at their job, it's a little less suspicious if they're doing something over off to the side. So I think a lot of it has to do with the ease of work from home and not having to actually be physically present in a job. So hiring someone based off of an AI interview, probably pretty easy to do. That's how I got this job.
No comment.
I was going to say, how do we know one of you isn't AI right now, you know? Right,
I think there's a perfect storm over here, right? I think Dave is right. One is, of course, the work from home or remote, wherever, right? Remote workforce. Second is the fact that we have increased amount of AI, right? That we're relying on that quite a bit, being able to go and scan for resumes, being able to validate a bunch of things. That's good and bad, right? And then the third piece is, you know, we don't have the number of, you know, HR individuals doing the manual process. The HR is getting a lot of pressure in terms of saying, okay, we need 100 jobs, we need 1,000 jobs, we need X number of jobs in this 3 years, do it yesterday. So it's a combination of remote, combination of the tools, and the combination of the fact that, you know, you've got accelerated hiring practices. To me, that is coming together into a perfect storm for fraudsters to go and say, hey, why rob a bank when I can go get hired by one?
I was just going to say that AI isn't Max Headroom anymore. I mean, it's a lot. Deep fakes are really, really good now. Yeah. It's not Forrest Gump meeting John Kennedy. It's a lot better than it used to be.
We got a Max Headroom reference this time. You know, I'm going to count on you every time now. I'm counting
every
on you for
time.
Some obscure stuff to come up here, right? But Michelle, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fraud scam that we didn't have before. So it's like, okay, now we're all getting used to this, right? We're seeing reports. Maybe a lot of organizations, like to Dave's point about, you know, now we're all, you know, moving remotely ever more than we were before. So, you know, within IBM, we're used to this global organization, but a lot of other organizations, maybe they start to expand their boundaries beyond their regional location, right? And so now we're hiring on, but we're not anticipating this type of, where did this come from, right? You're not going to know unless you're in the cybersecurity industry. So I think it's all, like anything else, it's awareness. It's end user education. Hey, HR staff, you know, this is what's coming. This is what's happening. We need to pay attention to this kind of stuff. So it's just a learning curve.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about, you know, what organizations can maybe do to start spotting more of this. And so it sounds like part of it is education, right? I guess you could also make everybody work in an office. It's pretty hard to be a scammer if you do that. But any other thoughts, though, on that? Sridhar, what you got to say?
I think it's a people, process, and technology, Michelle, right? To just add on to that, right? You know, one is, of course, the technology, right? We do CAPTCHA for stupid things that we shouldn't be doing, right? There's other things that you can do that. But we don't do liveness test for ghost employment, right? So I think being able to go and apply technology to be able to go and there's a lot of technology these days to go and check for liveness test, be able to go and scan your driver's license, go here, go there. I mean, you know, sorry to deviate, but I had to go. We had all, you know, plumbing fixtures and that had a lifetime warranty. And when we called the support desk, they said, oh, go up. Take a picture, go down, take a picture, send this. They want to make sure that it's in my home, right? We're doing that for plumbing fixtures. Why can't we do it for employment, right? So second, of course, you know, your point, Michelle, that I think education, right? Education is important. This absolutely is. And then the last piece is, you know, continuing to go monitor. I'm not saying that avoid breach the privacy aspects and things like that. But we got to, like Dave said, hey, that person looks suspicious. What is that equivalent in a non-work environment, right? I think that's something that we have to think about as a mechanism to detect anomalies and stop it, right? So
I think Sridhar hit the nail on the head. It's like having a kidnapping victim holding up a newspaper from the day.
Yeah.
Yes, this is me. I promise.
Let's move along to our last story, which this one, honestly, just something a little lighter. I found it amusing. Cyber criminal installs Huntress EDR on their device for some reason, giving security pros a front row seat to their activity. So it's exactly what it sounds like. A cyber criminal testing out new security tools installed Huntress's EDR on their device. Now, we know that cyber criminals, as we just said, they play with a lot of these legitimate security tools. But Huntress's team noticed that, you know, they installed this and it gave them the opportunity to look into what they were doing on their device. So once they confirmed it was a malicious actor, they started poking around, checking out their activity, including digging into previous stuff, like seeing what the attacker was researching, the attack frameworks they were looking into, phishing messages they were crafting, dark web markets they were visiting, all kinds of stuff. So I just, like I said, this was just extremely funny to me. I thought this was hilarious. And I just wanted to see what the rest of you thought. Dave, I see you cracking a smile. You got any thoughts on this one?
I want to know how long they let him do this before they went in there and started looking at things. Like, you know, it used to be one of the tactics is let them poke around for a little bit to see what they're going to do. And then the second that they get close to something that they're not supposed to, shut them down. Well, seems to me that Huntress's EDR people just said, huh, he's got our tool. You know what that means? We can go poke around. So it's like the opposite. We can go poke around in their environment and, like you said, see everything that they did. This was one of the dumbest things I've ever heard of a threat actor doing. Just one of the dumbest. I can't state that firmly enough. Was it on his production machine or was it on a test machine? Honeypot? I don't know. But not the smartest cookie in the bag.
Well, I think I actually grounds the whole thing, right? The fact that even attackers can make mistakes. I think, which is actually, we have a chance, Dave. We have a chance. Right now, right, the defenders are always chasing because they're not talking to each other, and whereas the attackers are doing a very good job of working with each other, right? So mistake like this not only show the human side of it that end of the day, they are human. They make mistakes. I mean, and to the other point, right, which is, but at the same time, what can we take away from that, right? It gives us a, you know, front row seat or a backstage pass to how they are orchestrating this whole thing. And then how should we think about our defenses, right? So that's what I was taking away.
I hope Huntress sent them a thank you card.
A nice fruit basket, you know?
Even better. Teddy bear and a fruit basket.
Michelle, any thoughts on your end?
Yeah, I mean, I immediately thought about actually some research that two analysts, and I'll have to give them credit here, Allison Wyckoff and Richard Emerson, they stumbled across open servers of the threat actor ITG-18, which I think we... TTP overlaps with Charming Kitten and a few other folks. Basically, videos showing how to train other attackers in their group. So the videos showed things like, this is how you compromise an account. And oh, by the way, if it has MFA, you know, disregard. Don't try to compromise this one. So it was very interesting inside look. So I immediately thought of that when I saw this article. But yeah, I mean, to go back to my analogy before of like, we all have busy days. Attackers have busy days too. Like they're going to do things like this. It's going to happen, right? These operational errors.
It's hard it's out there for a
big error. It's a large error.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Michelle and Sridhar and Dave, for joining us. Thank you to our viewers and listeners for tuning in. Special thanks to viewer Two Left Arms, who posted the hard-hitting question on our last episode. Would you rather be hacked by a billion lions or one of every Pokemon? The answer there is pretty obvious, if you ask me. It's the lions. They got real big paws. They can't type on the computer. You're set there. Make sure to subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. And everyone, please stay safe out there.